video come to order.
If members would like to take their seat. We're starting today with presentation from the DNR Fisheries Management section. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Ed Bogus from the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and this is a continuation of a presentation on the Division of Fish and Wildlife that we started in front of this division last Monday. And today we have the Fisheries Management Section Chief Ron Pyre to walk through the Fisheries Section. We did Wildlife and Licensing a week ago. So,
thank you.
With that, I'll turn it over to Ron.
Madam Chair, members, I've got 15 slides on the PowerPoint just set up to give some of our core activities in the fish management section and then talk about some of the critical challenges that we're facing. The mission of the Division of Fish and Wildlife simply parrots into the fish management section, and we're looking at fisheries and aquatic resources. Looking at fisheries at a glance in Minnesota, we manage 5,400 lakes and about 16,000 miles of streams. I'd say 3,500 of those lakes we actively manage. There's about 1,000 lakes in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness where we monitor. We serve about 1.5 million licensed anglers, about 1.2 resident, 340 or 50,000 non-resident anglers, and 600,000 non-licensed anglers. We do serve about 3,700 businesses in the state and generate somewhere between $1.5 billion and $3 billion a year in expenditures in the state. Minnesota consistently ranks in the top four states in the country in terms of number of resident hours fished, number of non-resident hours fished, total expenditures on fishing in Minnesota, and the percentage of residents that are licensed, and I'll talk about that trend a little bit later because that is declining. It's big business. It's estimated that recreational angling in the state generates about 50,000 jobs in Minnesota that are associated with fishing. A quick pie chart of last biennium, 06-07 operating funding. Can see that fisheries is really reliant on dedicated funding. 78% comes from the Game and Fish Fund, 13% from Heritage Enhancement. The dedicated account there, you see 3%, that's the trout and salmon stamp revenues and expenditures that we have. That's the only real stamp or surcharge that we have in fisheries. The Natural Resources Fund is water recreation account, and then we have a small amount of general funds primarily oriented towards managing the treaty in the 1837 treaty area. We've broken our primary services. You can lump and split quite a bit. We've lumped them into four primary categories, and the first is monitoring and applied research on fish populations and habitat, and that's just basically our store inventory. What's out there? What do we have? Helps us base our decisions. We do conserve, improve, and restore fish populations and habitat. We have a very aggressive fish stocking program, and then we work broadly with the public. The way I'll structure this is I'll go through each of those core activities and kind of identify some of the actions, some of the management activities within each, and then follow that with kind of the challenges that we're facing. The first one is inventory. Monitoring an applied resource, and when you see inventory fisheries resources, you'll see a lot of our trap nets and gill nets out on the lakes over the course of the summer, usually June through September. We go out and net about 660 lakes and 180 streams each year. That gives us our store inventory. We do measure activity outcomes, and that's primarily through our netting trends and analysis, and also through our creel surveys where we find out how much pressure, angling pressure there is, what they're catching, and what they would like to catch. We ask for anglers' attitudes when we do the creel surveys. We're only able to do about 30 creel surveys a year, so that limits our outcome measurement. We do monitor commercial licenses and permits for the commercial fisheries operations, and we'll talk in a little bit about the impacts on wetlands, or at least the concerns on wetlands. We maintain a very large database that businesses, other agencies, our staff, and the public are accessing and analyzing. And then we have a research component in fisheries management. It's functions out of the fisheries or the division policy unit. And some of the types of things they look at are community interactions. And we look at a situation like Leech Lake, for example, where we have cormorants and rusty crayfish and competing fish species. We'll look at how we can improve our sampling techniques rather than doing the creel surveys manually using cameras and modern technology. We do a fair amount or an increasing amount of angler dynamics and human dimensions. What does our public really desire? And that's one of the hardest things for us to gauge sometimes. And then the effects of fish rearing on wetlands has been a fairly big issue for us the last few years as the competing waterfowl fish rearing controversy comes. The next core function is with regards to habitat and populations. And good fisheries in our state and any state depends on good water quality and good habitat. If we don't have that as a foundation, we won't have sustainable fisheries. So we take a pretty hard look at aquatic habitat and populations. We have an acquisition program for what we call aquatic management areas. They're part of the statewide comprehensive outdoor system. Prior to 2001, it was primarily trout stream easements, and in the last few years, we've purchased more properties on shoreline. Aquatic plant management is an issue that we work with ecological services and enforcement on. Aquatic vegetation provides a lot of habitat for fish. It buffers wave action, and as we talk about challenges and stresses, we see that with curly-leaf pondweed and other invasives, it can also create a problem for riparian owners. Shoreland restoration is a growing program over the last 4 or 5 years. We see a lot of our shorelines, people desire to go down and manicure their lawn right to the shore with grass, remove the emergent vegetation, and over the long haul, that's going to create a lot of problems for our fisheries. Water quality monitoring, we're out on these lakes, we do assess water quality. We do some direct habitat improvement projects, spawning area development, trout habitat cover, dam removal up in the Red River primarily in recent years. Large lake management is a pretty big deal for fisheries management in Minnesota. And we have 10 large walleye lakes and then Lake Superior, and a lot of the fish harvest comes out of those 10 lakes. And if you think about the controversies that have generated around Mille Lacs Lake Treaty, Leech Lake walleye and cormorants, Red Lake recovery, Lake of the Woods, those are major waters. They're icons for us in the state, and we put a lot of energy into assessing those systems. And along with that, we look at harvest modeling. Our research unit helps us a lot in developing safe harvest levels for different fish species. And then regulations. In order to maintain the size and quality of fish that people want in this state, we either have to voluntarily or through regulations have some of those fish return. We have a large stocking program. Probably 15-20% of our budget is spent on stocking. The table here lists the primary species that we stock, and we stock to provide fishing where natural reproduction either is non-existent or not adequate to provide fisheries. And we do introduce species, and Gull Lake is an example where we'd propose putting muskellunge gen, so that would be an introduction of a species where there's been some public concern. But the major emphasis on our stocking in this state is with walleye and muskellunge, and then trout and salmon. And the kids' fishing ponds, I'll talk a little bit later on our fishing in the neighborhood program. We work a tremendous amount with the public. We have a Minocqua Aquatic Education Program to try to reach out on the recruitment retention issue. We reach about 63,000 people a year through our aquatic education program. And Finn is fishing in the neighborhood. And what the Metro fisheries managers have done is they've identified schools and drawn a radius around that, and we've tried to provide fishing opportunities within reasonable access to kids in those schools. And so we've stocked those ponds and we've provided access. So it's a way to try to reach out, recruit people, provide opportunities for them to angle. And we've got about 50 ponds in the Metro, seven county metro area right now that we manage under the Finn program. We do provide technical expertise for watershed management. I think it's often said good fishing begins on the land, because what happens there impacts water quality and what happens with the vegetation. So we have some watershed coordinators that work with local units of governments and citizens to help them. We've created what are called species workshops. Down a couple you'll see roundtable, and since 1991 we've convened a fishing roundtable that's tried to address the declining average size of fish for some of our fish species in Minnesota. And those have been pretty popular. Wildlife and Ecological Services meet at the same time fisheries does now. But we find that there's never enough time to really talk about the issues our stakeholders want to. So we've created what we call species workshops, and we've created them currently for bass, northern pike, muskie, walleye, and panfish. And we've invited folks in starting this spring for some more detailed discussion. They're not closed meetings. We just make sure that we have representatives so we're in detail able to get an assessment of what folks are interested in. We have a number of citizens oversight committees that review our funding. That's by statute. We meet with them regularly and solicit their input on policy. And we have advisory groups on fishing tournaments, aquaculture, and other topics. Probably the biggest partnership we have, though, is with our field staff. We have 28 area fisheries offices out and around the state, and those folks are meeting with the local constituency on a regular basis. I'll talk a little bit later on about workforce planning, because as is just about everybody right now, with the baby boomers phasing out of the workforce, we need to think about how we're going to manage that. Just quickly summarize some of the critical challenges to fisheries management in the state, and one of them is maintaining the sizes and numbers of fish to satisfy most anglers. We've got a large number of very good, very knowledgeable anglers. They're equipped with the very best of technology. They can pull up a website and find out the coordinates of a mud flat on Mille Lacs Lake and go right to that spot and know when and where they're biting. So the challenge is to meet demands. And on a given water, we can't meet everybody's demands. And that creates the sometimes public conflicts on how they would like to see us manage. So that's certainly a challenge for us. And part of the reason for the oversight or the species workshops is to help us work through some of those issues. Excuse me. Inventory frequencies. We prioritize our lakes. Our big lakes are surveyed annually. And then we tier 3 to 5 years. But on average, we're only able to get on our state lakes once every 9 years. And so getting a frequency, you think about a walleye that takes 3 or 4 years to get up to catchable size. If you're not in there for 8 years, you've missed a couple of cycles. So it's hard for us to do a trend analysis. And that's the next point, is estimating abundance and trends. Determining the public desire, and this gets into human dimensions, what do our constituents want, then oftentimes we'll have a public input meeting and we'll hear strong sentiment one way or the other, but when we go out and actually implement a regulation or a proposal, we find out that there's a host of other opinions out there. So measuring, engaging, and weighing public input is a challenge for us and will continue to be, particularly in light of the next point, which is accessible information. We're kind of an open book. All our information is available to the public, and these folks really understand fish and fish habitat, and they will go in and take our data and analyze it. So they're very knowledgeable about what we're doing. And then I would make a point on long-term monitoring, because that ties to things like climate change, and my last slide will touch on climate change a little bit. But we need to be able to take systems that are sensitive to change and monitor them on a regular basis so we can see what those changes are and also develop management strategies around those. Impaired waters is another issue. I think you're all familiar with that, whether it's mercury sediments, temperature, turbidity. Again, water quality is so key to what's going on with our fisheries and the sustainability. Land use changes, row crops, impervious surfaces, and urban areas all impact water quality. Loss of native aquatic plants. And again, riparian owners would like use and access of their properties and out to the lake. And when you look at curly-leaf pondweed on a lake like Lake Benton, where it's completely choking the lake, we can run into some issues that we need to resolve there. And then the impacts of cumulative effects. So a penny and a nickel at a time, if folks are impacting the resource, it might be within the bounds of their authority to do that, but over time you add those up and you might see a complete loss of vegetation or impacts of invasive species. We've got a couple of ventures, a National Fish Habitat Initiative, where we're working with six other Midwest states to try to address that on a more comprehensive scale, to see what they're doing, share and pool resources, and perhaps garner some federal funding or private funding. And we also are starting to work on some statewide shoreline development rules. The agency did a 5-county pilot. They're voluntary right now. It's been controversial in that arena, but I think everybody agrees we need to address shoreline rules at some point in time. This next slide, the ensuring angler access, that's something that is always an issue for us, particularly on streams. We've created a citizens advisory group to help counsel us on developing an acquisition plan, similar to what wildlife did. Another challenge is the increasing cost of shoreland. As we try to protect lakeshore and the habitat there, the cost is very prohibitive, so we need partners, cost sharing, as well as looking at things like conservation easements. Advancements in fishing technologies. And what we're facing in Minnesota, I would assess our fisheries in Minnesota as being in very good shape. If you look at bass and trout and walleye and muskie and catfish, some of the best fishing we've ever had. The species we're having troubles with are species like perch and panfish and northern pike, where people want to harvest, and we call that quality over harvest. It's not numbers, it's average size, trying to get that average size out there. So as anglers get better and we see more technology and more demands for an increased pressure, we're already straining at the seams to try to keep that quality out there. So that's a challenge for us, as well as simplifying effective regulations. And we have about 45 regulations, for example, to try to improve walleye quality. And so we need to manage individually where we can, and yet we don't want the regulations so complex that it scares people away. So we're conscious of that. Ties into the stocking. If you look at one of the challenges is introduction of new species, and we're proposing putting muskellunge, that's kind of the one on the table recently, into some systems that either haven't had them or haven't had them for a long time, and that's an issue for us. Preventing the spread of pathogens. The VHS is viral hemorrhagic septicemia. It's a very nasty virus that's coming through the Great Lakes. It will be in Lake Superior. It will change how we do business up there. We're already going to pull the plug on rearing suckers and walleye maybe up there. We've got other diseases and invasive species, and I think the point there is that it will change how our agency does business and how the public is impacted by that as we try to control the spread of invasive species and diseases. It seems like it's coming through almost every month, particularly on a system like Lake Superior with the ballast water discharge. Partnerships, recruitment, and retention. One of the things we're facing is a decrease in angler participation, especially between ages 16 and 44. Right now, and since the 70s, we've licensed between about 1.5 million and 1.6 million anglers. That's projected to go down to about 1.4 million in 2015. In 1991, 40% of the residents in Minnesota were licensed. In 05, it was 29%, and it's projected to go to 24% in 2015. So we're seeing participation. The number of licenses staying flat, but we're losing ground to population increase. And some of the things that are impacting that are age, as us baby boomers age, urbanization, and some of the racial ethnic interests that are out there. The Midwest is holding ground very well. If you look at charts of the Midwest compared to the Western states and Northeast, we're not dropping nearly as fast as they are, and they use us as a model. Nonetheless, we are dropping. And if you look at the number of folks that will turn 65 here in the next 10 years, you see angling participation starting to drop off. So that's a very key component on how we're managing our fisheries. Some of the other challenges include increased runoff and nutrient loading. This is kind of a climate change overview. That's something that's going to change habitat in our state. And again, it's pretty inevitable. I think even if we started turning the clock back, we'll see some changes. There's talk that in 50 years we're going to end up similar to St. Louis in terms of our climate. So that's something, invasive species, wetland complexes, how do we do business again? And again, that points out the need for some long-term monitoring. We have to start getting a handle on that so we can develop strategies. I'm going to go back one slide. I apologize for missing. Involving people in decision-making is a key for us. And again, it comes down to how do we gauge who should we involve? And there's always somebody that feels that they haven't been involved. And then there's competing interests. Somebody that wants muskellunge, trophy muskellunge on a lake or trophy northern might be impacting spearing interests, or somebody that wants to harvest more fish. The last thing I'll bring up is workforce planning. We're, like everybody else, we're facing somewhere in a 30 to 40% loss of folks as they retire, and managing that, retaining the expertise, transitioning that expertise is going to continue to be a challenge for all of us, and we're actively trying to address that. But I know in our section alone, we're losing to retirement at least three people that have been around 30 plus years and have contributed greatly, and so we need to transition. No, that was a very quick overview. I know your schedules are tight, but if it triggered any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Thank you.
Representative Moe?
I think Representative McNamara actually had his hand up there before me.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perez, good to see you. I see up in my neck of the woods quite a bit. When you talk about stocking and the challenges you face with that, and then you hit on the end how you intentionally bring in citizens, and which you do up in the decisions you've made around Leech Lake, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the challenges that you face with those differing constituent groups. As you know, there are groups, there are members of a community in the Walker area who are concerned about the stocking level. members of your staff and them don't always agree, but I know from experience that you're very committed to that program. However, you can never make them all happy. You know, when you put your resources there, there's fewer resources available for Woman Lake or for Lake Winnie. So maybe if you just kind of address that challenge a little bit, and then the second question would be, if you stock 1 year, why don't you stock every year? I mean, I know the answer to that, but maybe you could address, tell the committee.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Moe, on the first question, stocking is a real tangible activity. People see the fish going in, and there's a kind of an assumption that it works maybe sometimes better than it does. On the other hand, we stock 900 lakes, for example, with walleye, and it provides some tremendous fishing opportunities where there wouldn't be any otherwise. And we work with groups. A lot of times we can reach agreement on a stocking regime that might include their stocking, private stocking, changes in rates, and an evaluation. And a key for us is evaluating stocking. Our folks have been managing out there for a lot of years, and they've got some pretty good history. We don't have all the answers, and so we're continually getting more information. So as we bring people in the Walker area, there's a Walker Area Walleye Coalition, probably is the hot spot on stocking right now. I don't hear much about stocking from around the state except there, and they're frustrated. They feel their fishing has gone down. So we meet with them on a frequent basis, try to provide our best information and our best assessment of a strategy, an entire management strategy that would work. And I would say that most of the time we're successful in doing that, and we work pretty closely with the public. Occasionally there's simply a disagreement, particularly on a few lakes, where there's a strong sense that we should stock more fish, and we just feel it would either be detrimental or clearly not beneficial to that system based on our experience. So over the last few years, we developed what's called a core walleye program, and the agency went from stocking in littoral acres less than 15 feet deep. We'd stocked about a half a pound of walleye fingerlings per littoral acre per year. That was the most cost-effective stocking mechanism. That was the best benefit to the angler in terms of dollars spent. We changed that strategy. The agency went to 1 pound per littoral acre per year. And that's the highest return to the nets. And so doubling in your stocking, we're estimating, will return 20 to 25% more fish to the net. So it's not an even Steven. After that, you start losing ground. So our hope is, it takes about 5 to 10 years to evaluate the success of that. We've been more aggressive. We're purchasing from the private sector. So we're hopeful that we'll be allowed to evaluate that and find out where it's really working. Just quickly on the why do we not stock every year, there's a pretty comprehensive analysis by the University of Minnesota that indicated that if you stock heavily 2 years in a row, you may actually suppress the year class on either side, and it's simply a competition for food. So if you get, for example, a lot of young fish in 2006, you stock heavily in 2007, you could actually negatively impact that year class before and the year class ahead. So we found in general that stocking every other year provides the best return to the angler.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Moe.
If there were more resources available to you, would you stock more?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I think with the core program and maximizing the return to the nets, I think we have the resources we need now to evaluate whether or not that's going to work. I do not think we would need more stocking resources at this point in time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fair, my question is in regards to weed rollers and the popularity. What effect are they having on the fisheries, and what's the DNR's position on banning them?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not sure on the agency's position on banning. We've permitted them, and we've tried to allow their use in situations where they wouldn't basically dredge the bottom. The problem we've had where there's silt and softer sediments is that as they roll around, they create berms, and they really impact the habitat. So we've tried to permit those to situations where they would have a minimal negative impact on the resource. And as enforcement does flights and we take a look, it's obvious that neighbors are sharing them. They leave a pretty definitive footprint. You can fly over and you can see where the circles are, where they've been used. And there's obviously quite a bit of abuse of their utilization in those cases. So we're continuing to work on that. Ecological Services is the primary permitter. Our field staff are out looking at things, but Ecological Services, Steve Anger and crew are taking a look at how we can better deliver that program.
Just a quick follow-up. Why wouldn't we just ban them? What good are they? I mean, you didn't answer as far as the DNR. Why, as a fisheries person, you can't like them.
Representative McNamara, Mr. Pair, we need to be moving along. We have several bills to hear, so if we could keep our questions and answers.
Well, that'll be a future bill, Madam Chair.
Representative Bouguenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick things, then. You said that if people get to be 65, fishing licenses will go down, and that just struck me as why. This is when people have more time. Why isn't there more fishing? And why wouldn't we have that expectation? And the second thing is you talk about decreases in angler participation between 16 and 44 years of age, and that's another why question. And the third question is a lot of states now are checking their fish to see if they can reproduce, checking male fish to see if they can endocrine disruptors have affected them. Are you doing that? Those are my three quick questions.
Madam Chair, Representative Bouguenius, on the first one, the National Survey of the Fish and Wildlife Service does indicates that after 65, and a lot of it may be related to health and who to fish with, you do see a drop in angling participation. And that's a double whammy for us as the younger folks are not, and that's generally due to just increased time. If you look at why people don't angle, it's not enough time, nobody to fish with, there's some basic risk, school, just too busy in today's society. So that's what the demographics are showing us, and that's what we're trying to turn around. As far as endocrine disruptors, DNR is working with Health and PCA on the Mississippi River. I think that's primarily being looked at through Ecological Services and PCA. Yes, we're certainly concerned. I'm not aware of any other instances other than the Mississippi River at this point in time where that's an issue.
Representative Bouguenius.
Well, I see states like Idaho being concerned just across the board and not just in the Mississippi River, and I don't think you'd know without testing. And one of the reasons I bring it up, there's a brand new study out on atrazine and how potent it is as an endocrine disruptor for fish, and I'll share it with you. It just came out about 2 or 3 days ago.
Representative Simpson, to you.
Just a quick one. I'm sorry I got here late. Maybe this was answered, but does the DNR still, or did we or do we sell walleye fry out of state to other states?
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, we do not. We exchange once in a while. Our priorities are to meet our own program needs and then the private industry. Occasionally we will trade with Michigan for a lake trout or something, but most of those fish from our operations stay in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Pair, for your testimony.
Thank you. Okay, we apparently have a quorum. We'll call the meeting to order. We have minutes from the last meeting. Representative McGinnis, you move the minutes. Representative McGinnis, we move the minutes of February 5th. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Minutes are approved February 5th. Okay, members, we have five bills before us today. The first bill is House File 73, Representative Hodge. Are you here? Yep, he's here. Representative Hodge, you'll come down front. Representative Riccovina, you'll be next. And Representative Hodge, House File 72 will be before us. Representative Moe, you move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move House File 72 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus scheme and fish bill.
All right. Representative Hodge, House File 72 is before us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And I do apologize if I have to leave somewhat early because I will be having another
Don't
bill.
Don't apologize. Everybody's busy. You keep going.
House File 72 came out actually from a constituent issue in my district in which some constituents of mine invented a new baiting mechanism and our current statutes, however, are ambiguous in the fact that some conservation officers are interpreting the fact that you cannot use any containers or metal containers for baiting of bears. It's a good product that has been introduced. It's been used in several states such as New York, Maine, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Idaho, and throughout Canada. And what we want to do today is just to put clarification within our statutes allowing the use of this product. It's a product that allows a timed release of bait. It has six drawers in it, so it can be released on a per-day basis, so you don't have to keep going back to the site every day and restocking your bait. Bear hunters know that can be an arduous task many times, and I do have the individuals who manufacture this product and hold the patents to this product here today that can also answer any questions from the committee, and I would just like to see if there's any questions or input.
Hey, members, any questions right now, Representative Hodge? Being none, if you'd like to bring forward your testifier. Welcome to committee. If you state your name, who you represent, go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Mike Lucan, I'm with Bear Busters.
And I'm Kirsten Lucan.
Welcome.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
And we were just wanted to clarify the law so we can use our baiter in the state. We've been selling throughout the U.S. and Canada, and we just want to make sure that it is legal in Minnesota. But right now, the way the law reads, it's kind of iffy.
We have discussed this issue with conservation officers, and it's kind of been a half split. Half of them have said that based upon the law, it's part of the bait, and therefore it's illegal as the law is currently written. The other half have stated that it's not part of the bait, and consequently it wouldn't be illegal to use.
Okay, and you currently live in Minnesota. You also make these in Minnesota and sell them?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, I'd be curious to get the DNR's opinion on this.
Well, we're going to get to them. Okay. Why don't you stand by? We might have some more questions for you, so don't take off. Mr. Bogus, you have input on this bill, House File 72? Thank you very much. If we don't get back to you, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and we don't really have a position on this bill. I just want to point out a couple of things in terms of why we are where we are, and then one point that we think the committee needs to keep in mind as you're considering this bill. But the department puts out information to bear hunters, a little regulations booklet every year that summarizes the rules and provides other information on how to take care of meat, things like that, and we've always interpreted current statute to where it says in the bill on lines 1.9 and 1.10, to attract bear, a person may not use a bait with, and then if you go down to item number 5 on line 1.16, it says materials that are not readily biodegradable, and it's been our interpretation that includes the container that you leave at the bait site. Because containers can range anywhere from a plastic bag, a garbage bag, a bread bag, to a plastic ice cream bucket or 5 gallon bucket, to a 55 gallon drum. And it's been our interpretation that the intent on biodegradable materials used with bait, that all of those were not allowed. We did clarify that a person could obviously bring bait out in a bucket, you know, and that's perfectly legal as long as they don't leave the bucket when they leave the bait site. So that's what brought this issue, I think, before the committee. We're familiar with this device. We met with your testifiers. Some of our staff did earlier this fall. We don't think this would create the kind of the littering issue that I think the law was trying to avoid, because it's a large, heavy steel, remote-controlled, motorized kind of a device that is very expensive and is not going to be left out in the woods to create a litter problem. The issue that we think you just need to think about, and we're thinking about it too, although, like I said, we really don't have a position on this, is that this introduces one more level of technological advancement into bear hunting in terms of the way this device functions. It allows you to program when various compartments are open and available to the bear, and trail timers and cameras and things like that have been used by bear hunters for many years to determine when the bear is visiting the site. This device now will allow the potential for a person to habituate the bear, change its behavior to come at different times. One of the problems bear hunters encounter is bears coming at night when it's close shooting hours. So with this device, you could program it to gradually move that bear's behavior till it's coming during shooting hours rather than after shooting hours. So, but like I say, we already have a lot of technology in hunting, including bear hunting, you know, we leave it to the legislature to decide if this is something that we want to do. But it does address our concerns, just given the cost and the construction of this, in terms of, we're not concerned this can be left in the woods, which was the primary reason the law, current law, was worded the way that it is.
Mr. Bogus, do they have to? Does the bear hunter have to have on the site a display tag? Does that include his name and address and the hunter's license? Or I don't hunt bears, so I'm not familiar with that part of the. Of existing law.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it's there has to be a sign at the site that includes the name and address, or name and driver's license number, and then also they're required to send in a postcard naming the section of land in which they've placed baits.
Representative Hosh, how much did one of these bear baiting contraptions cost?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Particular item is $799, so it is a significant investment, and if there's concerns about this being left at the site after the bear hunting season, I think most people know that a significant investment won't be left at the site. The monies that we invest in decoys, whether it be duck or geese, are also, we don't leave our decoys out at our blinds, so I think that is another argument that, you know, the statute has been written specifically enough to deal with the concerns that the DNR has posed, and should not lead to any littering.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hosh, so, and Mr. Bogus, maybe you can answer this. So, but the law still would allow those people who can't afford an $800 bear baiting system to bring out a bucket, correct?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, yeah, this would not change any of the existing techniques that are currently legal.
And is there any requirements upon the material that bucket be made out of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, it's Right now, we're just saying you can't leave any non-biodegradable materials at the site. But you can carry it out in whatever kind of a bucket you can lift and carry, as long as you bring it back out when you leave.
Thank you, Mr. Vargas.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vargas, I've got some real concerns. I represent Hosh, really. We're going down the wrong road here. We're one of the few states that still allow the baiting of air, and I think I'm a huge supporter of that, and I think it's really important. And I don't want to see us mechanizing hunting. This is the wrong direction. We're actually going to change a habit of the animals so they come in when we want to be there. No, this is, I just really feel bad. And then we're saying, well, if you're a poor student and all you've got is a bucket to haul your bait out and you're going to go out there every 2 days, ride out on your bike and put your bait out, but some retired landscaper who happens to have the money can afford an $800 machine, he'll just put it out and then adapt the habit of it. No, this is the wrong thing to do, and I'm surprised Mr. Boggs, the DNR, wouldn't be vehemently opposing this as you're here.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara. In regards when it comes to the cost and the different products, we see that, I think, in all of our hunting genres, the investments that you can make and the products that are available. And you can see that whether it be deer hunting, duck hunting, pheasant hunting, whatever it may be. That's an individual choice, and that applies here also. When it comes to mechanizing the sport, this is used throughout our country, throughout Canada. I think it's an appropriate use. It doesn't change the current resources that we have. Baiting is available. This is just another way to attain that. And when we talk about access to hunting, I also think it's important for many members, whether you be urban members that may hunt up north, instead of having to make that 2-3-4 hour drive every day to go back to your baiting site, that you have the ability to have a product that allows you to go out there once a week and hopefully provide more access to our families and to younger children hopefully getting into the sport.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I was going to let it go, but I will just tell you, Representative Hosh, you just stated exactly why we shouldn't do it. This is a sport that takes a real commitment, and the vast majority of the states don't allow this. If I'm not mistaken, we're one of only about, 11 states maybe that allow bear to be hunted in this manner currently. Mr. Boggess, how many states allow baiting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I don't know off the top of my head how many allow baiting. The reason we allow baiting for bears in Minnesota and not for other species is because in the heavily forested habitats that we have, there's really only two effective ways to hunt bears. One is with bait, the other is with hounds, and we don't allow hounds, so it's one or the other, basically.
Representative Genius.
Yes, I think folks, Mr. Helland has research information brief in our packet, which talks about, it says currently baiting is illegal in 30 of the 40 states with viable bear populations. And there's a little asterisk at the bottom which shows which states have passed prohibitions.
Do we have anybody interested in testifying for or against the bill? Come forward. Thank you, Ms. Boggess. Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Linda Hatfield, and I'm representing myself. I'm born and raised in Minnesota, so and I still live here. Lived in Minneapolis my whole life, and I'm testifying against this bill. I think it will cause more harm to bears, obviously, and the ecosystem, and that's already been addressed by Representative McNamara. I feel that, as Representative McNamara said, that more people will feel it's like it's going to make it easier, more convenient to get people out in the field to hunt. So I think it'll cause more damage to the ecosystem as a whole. We have more people out there. Ed Boggess said with the DNR, it will make the bears more habituated. So now we're changing their time schedules. Oh, now they can eat at 10 a.m. instead of at 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. Will this also create other animals having an interest in this, coming to these bear bait sites? At the same times, what will the effect be on their communities, their ecosystems, their interaction with the other animals in the field. Finally, I just want to say I think that bear baiting is a very unsportsmanlike practice. It's like shooting fish in a barrel, bears in a barrel, ducks in a barrel. Where's the sport in it? So I think it just makes it more unsporting all around. I think it's for the lazy hunter. And I just think all in all it's a bad idea, and I urge the members of this committee to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions to the testifier? Being none, Representative Hosh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'd like to reiterate that baiting is already a practice in Minnesota, and I think that's important to remember. Again, bear hunting is also a regulated sport. We have a lottery system when it comes to the licensing. It is not as easy as some want to portray. You don't put a bucket out in the woods and the bear come to you and you're going to shoot it. You've got between a 30 to 40% success rate. Deer hunting is more successful on its success rate than bear hunting. We have to manage the population of bears. There has been in the past instances of bear and human interaction that has been problematic, and we've been able to get some control over that. Also, the bear population has been increasing in the last few years. I believe that's stabilized now most recently, and we're at about 30,000 when it comes to the population throughout the state. We have a capable and competent DNR that is able to monitor our populations when it comes to our species throughout the state. They will be able to continue to regulate this sport, and this product is not going to make it where a bear is going to come up to you whenever you want it to. There's very much of a sport aspect to this, and it's also in the best interest of many of our communities throughout the state of Minnesota, in particular northern Minnesota. So I think that's important to consider.
Okay, I think the committee is...
Mr. Chair, I was going to let this go, but in response to Representative Hosh just said it won't get the bear to come when you want it to. Well, that's what the brochure is advertising that it's going to do. I mean, either it will or it won't, but if that's what the product is going to do, I mean, we can't have it both ways.
I think the committee is fully informed, and I think Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 72 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Representative Hosh, and those who testified for and against the bill. Thank you very much. Okay, members, House File 500 will be before us. Representative Rukavina, I'll move your bill, House File 500, to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Representative Rukavina, to your bill.
I'll hopefully make this quick for the committee because it's being backed up a little bit. Roger Hulk from the Capable Partners met with me today, and they've got a few concerns about this. I had put this bill in once before, withdrew it when they had concerns, and the DNR said they'd work with me and the constituent who had asked me to put this in, but it never happened, so I put it in again. But if you would just make your motion and have it for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair, I promise both Capable Partners, who represent a lot of disabled hunters, and the DNR that I'd work with them to try to, because they're concerned about the language I'm eliminating and what chronic means. I think I know what chronic means, but they're concerned about that. So, I don't believe anybody's going to testify.
Well, Representative Rukavina, that is my motion, is that it'll be held over for the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. So why don't we have DNR come up and... is there anybody from DNR wants to talk about this? Mr. Meyer, come down and testify. I got to get the title right. Almost called him representative. He ought to be.
He's here. And Mr. Chair, before he's coming down, I can tell you, I went to visit Representative McNamara at his hunting shack right up the road.
On the Whiskey Road?
It's on the Mud Lake Road.
Mud Lake.
In your district, it's got this little thing that turns at 7 in the morning and kicks out corn. But I don't know.
Representative Rukavina, that was supposed to be yours and my secret.
No. For the team, that has not ever happened. But I will say, as long as thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, I want to say thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I look forward to Assistant Commissioner Meyer's testimony that some poor guy on oxygen can't hardly get out of his car, hasn't been able to get a doctor's permit to get a
permit.
Well, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, welcome to the committee. Why don't you state your name and for the record, and then we will listen to your testimony on House File 500.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The way the current system works, a person that meets the qualifications in statute needs a signed letter from their doctor. And working with Representative Rukavina on this issue in the past, the individual has not received a letter that's signed from his doctor. It's a form that they fill out, sign, they send it back to us. I think, as you're aware, the way the bill is written, it opens the system wide up. And these permits are something that we need to really keep control over with strict criteria that's out there. Stakeholder groups that we work with very closely on these cable partners and other groups that track these types of issues do have some concerns about opening this program up as wide as it is. I spoke with Representative Rukavina before the hearing, and we are willing to sit down. We will sit down and talk with him and also work with cable partners to see if there are some changes we might be able to provide to this language to help the individual in need or to help people who should be or want to get out and enjoy the wilderness in ways that are safe and effective for them to do so. So between now and the wrap-up of your bill out of committee, I hope we can come back with some language that meets those requirements but also keeps it strict enough to also provide the barriers that we need.
Questions from the committee? Sounds like everyone's satisfied with the idea that you're going to work this out, and we'll move forward with getting it in the bill at a later time.
Back is a hard part.
Yeah, we're very good. Okay, I'll renew my motion to lay House File 500 over for the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, with the knowledge that you're going to be working with the fine Representative Rukavina on the balance of the content. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Rukavina, for coming before the committee.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, the next bill up, Representative Anzell. House File 354. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad you wrote this out for me. I move House File 354 to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources with the recommended re-referral to the Committee on Finance and for re-referral to Higher Education and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division. Does everybody have that straight?
Oh, what a motion. All right. House File 354, welcome, Representative
Thank you.
The first time before our committee.
Thank you.
Good northern legislator, a lot of trees. Tell us about your bill.
Lots of trees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is a piece of legislation that is good for my friends and neighbors in the Chippewa National Forest where I live. It's good for loggers, it's good for truckers, it's good for mills, it's good for county units of government, and we think it's good for the northern Minnesota economy. As you know, we have a patchwork quilt of land ownership in northern Minnesota, which is constantly evolving and changing, difficult to discern. And what we find is from time to time, timber sales on state land are delayed, and in many times are pulled from the list. And this piece of legislation, and by the way, I know of no opposition to this language, this piece of legislation would require an economic impact study to be completed in consultation between DEED and the Commissioner of the DNR, assessing the impact of pulling off the sale timberlands and the impact that eliminating these sales would have on the local economy and, in particular, local units of government. So essentially, that is the gist of the legislation. Wayne Brandt from the Minnesota Forest Industries and Timber Producers Association is in the room, I believe, and
Mr. Brandt, can you come
willing to help out?
Welcome, and state your name for the record to go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anzels. My name is Wayne Brandt, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Timber Producers Association. I think that while this is not our legislation, it came from some of Representative Anzels' constituents. I think that it would be a reasonable set of information for decision makers, be they the department or the legislature, to have in front of them before decisions as outlined in the bill were made. It would seem to me that an analysis could be incorporated either into the department's sustainable forest resource management planning process, or could be utilized on a time-to-time basis for other policies or decisions that are considered outside of the SFRMP. It would seem to me that it would provide a more robust set of information for any decisions that could be made, but wouldn't necessarily prejudge or preclude any of those decisions. Just provide a little more information and a little more sunshine as the department and other decision makers consider the issues before them. So we support Representative Anzels' bill and would urge its passage and further consideration by the other committee staffs outlined in the motion.
Well, Mr. Brandt, is this, you know, when I first read this bill, I was thinking that it was about a timber sale that was taken off of the, but what I really see this as is if, and correct me if I'm wrong, if the department or someone decides that they'd like to promote a scientific and natural area that happens to encompass an area that would normally be used for timber production or a wildlife management area, certainly wildlife management areas I support, but if it were a timbered area, that economic impact would play into this and it would require them to do the study. Is that how you see this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I could certainly see it utilized in that instance or other other policy or land allocation decisions that would be considered, in the future. I think, you know, it could also potentially be considered, while it doesn't say this specifically, it could be considered for issues relating to the fiduciary responsibilities of the permanent school trust fund lands in particular. So, I mean, I think we'll just provide more information, and I think that information would then inform the decision makers, be they those here or those in the department.
Mr. Brandt, I'm thinking that I recall things like this happening. I'm going to describe a scenario, and then you can tell me if your knowledge if it's happened. Up in the Superior, for example, or maybe in the Chippewa, in Representative Anzels' area, there are these very sensitive economic studies that are not economic, environmental studies, the EISs that occur. From time to time, is there state land that abuts U.S. Forest Service land that's impacted, and the state doesn't go forward with harvesting when they normally would because there's other impacts on neighboring land, and they're waiting to find out what the determination is on the neighboring land, and would this be a useful tool in that instance?
Mr. Chairman, state and local ownership, local public ownership, and frankly local private ownership has an absolute right under the ANILCA Act to access and manage their lands, even if they are completely surrounded by federal lands. Where the concern that you were, I think, speaking to arises is that frequently there can be additional delays in acquiring that access. I think that another, and I know the committee's got other issues, but I think another instance where, you know, this could have been utilized in the past was when the although I doubt that a different decision would have been arrived at, when the state developed old growth guidelines, and we supported those guidelines, the implementation of those guidelines. It would seem to have been appropriate to have had the information on the impacts on school trust lands in particular, even with that information, you know, my guess is the department's position wouldn't have changed. My guess is that, I know our position as an industry would not have changed, because we believe that it was appropriate to protect the limited number of old growth stands that were available here in the state. So I think we'll just provide a little more information as the department moved forward and was managing the forest lands.
Okay, any questions of Mr. Brandt? And I see Mr. Tomlinson here. Maybe he did. You want to come up, Mr. Tomlinson, and about this at all? Anyone from the department?
Quick question.
Doesn't look like they want to talk about it. Oh, Mr. Meyer will. Okay, any question? Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Representative Amzelson. In your first a statement and then a question. In your description of the bill, you said purely economic factors. I would argue too, with the fragmentation and the possibility that we could lose a lot of this land out of timber production that has all sorts of ecological benefits too, wildlife benefits that this would protect. Those benefits to our northern Minnesota lands as well. And so, not that you need to include that in your language, I just wanted to point out that, in my view, this is a great conservation measure potentially too. And specifically, would you think that this would be a useful tool for us, say if a county or state were to want to dispose of land, publicly held land, that is currently used for timber production, prevent the possibility of that happening, perhaps? Maybe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moe, my comment on the first part was yes, absolutely. And secondly, my response would be the northern Minnesota forested area is an area where retirees and people formerly from the area, and in fact folks who have never lived there before, are moving to northern Minnesota. We welcome them. We want them to come. But we also need to educate them as to forest practices, the economic impacts of the forest in which they're privileged to live in. And so I think that this study can help us in sharing information with them as well as the ecological and all of the other environmental concerns that you raise.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, before us again.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We did briefly discuss this issue with the author before committee. Do we have some general concerns about it, the breadth of the lands that it covers, of course, the cost of doing these reports and what it does to some of those issues. And, you know, we do have strong fiduciary responsibilities to many types of land to manage for the trusts that are out there. So it does have some impact to those, but we basically welcome the opportunity to work with the author and the committee as this bill moves forward to kind of address some of those concerns and make it a better bill.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Helen, you down there? Would this apply to tax forfeit, state tax forfeit that the county manages? So if the county wanted to sell a piece of tax forfeit land that was currently in timber production, would the same economic study have to be done? You don't have to answer that this second if you want to take a minute on it, and we can go on take other questions. Members, questions from the committee on the bill? House File 354. Representative Guinness.
As I read this, there is no consideration of conservation or ecological balance here, so the commissioner can only look at one thing. Would it be your intention to remain that focused, or are you open for looking at the breadth and of the issue?
Madam Chair and Representative Wiginius, most certainly this is a work in progress, and I will certainly give due diligence to the conservation and environmental aspects as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from members? Okay, anyone to testify for or against the bill from the audience, other than the agencies that we've had before us? Okay. This bill, again, the motion by Representative Moe was to send this, I have to read this motion, it's almost a paragraph, as I remember what it is, to send it to the Committee on Finance, which will refer it to Representative Wagenius's committee, the way I understand the way it's working. So maybe between the time that we have this bill before here and the time that it can get to your committee and get a hearing, then maybe we can work on some of that. And, well, it goes on a path. Let's put it that way. It's a quite a lengthy one. It says, Committee on Environment and Natural Resources was recommended to pass and referral to the Committee on Finance and a further referral to Higher Ed, which is Representative Rekovina, Representative Wagenius.
I think we need to consider whether it should go to Higher Ed first before it ends up in Finance, because if there's a financial implication, it will have to be carried with the Finance bill.
Mr. Kudelka. What do you think of that? I'm putting you on the spot.
I just know that Representative Rupanina's committee has asked to look at it for the policy of deed.
Well, let's send it to them. Let's send it to Representative Rukavina first when we make the final motion. Mr. Helen, did you find anything for us?
Mr. Chair, I think it may include tax forfeited lands. If they're in a forest classification, then they are under the authority of the commissioner, but I haven't found the state.
Could you just give that information to Representative Enzel before
right.
he gets to his next stop in the process here
okay. So
that he knows the answer to that question? I'm sensing from reading the legislation that it would include that tax forfeit. Representative Hagbarth, how do you read that? Same way? Okay. All right, so any other members, anything else before the members in terms of questions for Representative Enzel on House File 354? Okay, Representative Moe renews his motion, and Representative Moe, can your motion reflect that it go to Higher Ed first before it goes to Finance?
You know, I'm not going to try to rewrite this, Mr. Chairman, but the intent is to be referred to Higher Ed and Workforce Development Finance before it goes on to Representative Wagenius's committee. Assuming it passes.
Very good. Now, does everyone understand that motion? Everybody, Representative Wagenius, you okay with that? Okay, all in favor of the motion on House File 354?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
All right. House File 197. Is that the next one? Representative McNamara, do you move? Representative Hagbarth will move the bill. House File 197 is before us. To the bill, House File 197.
Thank
Representative Hagbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 197 be recommended to pass and be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is a lifetime trapper's license bill. Some of you might remember a number of years ago, I think it was 5-6 years ago, might have been about 2001, I think, we passed these lifetime licenses for hunting and fishing. At that particular time, we did not include the trapper's license, and I think it was an oversight on our part, or maybe it was something from the DNR. I don't remember what the situation was at the time, but I believe that the trapper should have been included in this, and this bill does just that. It also creates a trapper's lifetime license. So, members, that pretty much wraps up the bill. And with me today, I have Mr. Greg Floor. He is with the Minnesota Trappers Association, and he's the representative to MOHAW, Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. And he has a few words to say about the bill.
Welcome to committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and then who you represent, go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Greg Floor. I represent myself and the Minnesota Trappers Association. We would encourage you to pass this House File number 197. To make us equal with the rest of them by having to have a lifetime license. Right now we have to purchase two different licenses, and that would just streamline that. And not to take up any more time, I just encourage you again to pass this, as Minnesota Trappers Association has endorsed it.
Okay. Representative Hagbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was also heard in the Environment Committee in the Senate. And I understand that there was some language that was an amendment to the bill, and it simply, I don't have the language in front of me, Mr. Chairman, but I would bring that back if you would approve the bill and hold it over. It simply just
makes the bill retroactive back rather than have two separate licenses out there right now. It would also say that other sports licenses and small game licenses would also include the trapping.
So what you're saying is, Representative Hackbarth, you said in the Senate they amended the bill to reflect that language?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and they held the bill over for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill also.
So what you're saying, if I understand what you're saying the amendment said was, is that going back to when these licenses were originally issued, that they would now have added to them retroactively the trapping.
That's correct.
We had a very, very preliminary discussion with the department on what the cost of this might be, and I know this is a policy committee, but I thought that it would be something of interest to have a general idea of some of the costs. And Mr. Kadelka, could you give us the information that you received on that particular thing?
Yeah, and well, they figured out being $2,500 per year being the cost, and they figured that these are preliminary numbers. By using the sold-to-date numbers of small game lifetime licenses of 293 and sportsman licenses of 4,399, of those folks, 119 bought trapping license in 2006, and that's how they calculated their cost per year. That doesn't count people who may purchase a lifetime license because of the change, but that was their preliminary numbers, according to Pete Squira.
And I think that some more work will have to be done on that by the time you get to Representative Wagenius's committee, get a little more definitive answer on that. But by doing what you're suggesting, and I assume you're going to do that, we'll hold the bill in here and you'll come in and do the amendment, that we treat the others fairly then that bought the license that prior to us making this decision. I think I understand what is before us. Other members of the committee have questions on House File 197? All right. Mr. Kadelka, do we have the same motion then, and then just to hold the bill here in committee until we get it in the shape that we want to send it out to Environment Finance? Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you considering including it in the Game and Fish Bill and then sending that to the Finance Committee, or are you moving the bill along on its own?
I think we'll move. Representative Genius, how can you give me some advice on that? How do you think you'd like to see that move? I'm thinking that I'd like for it to travel on its own.
And Mr. Chair, just though, the Senate did hold it over for possible inclusion in their Game and Fish Bill.
Okay. Representative Genius.
That's up to you, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether your Game and Fish Bill as a whole will need to go to Finance or not.
Why don't we, Representative Hackbarth, why don't we go ahead and move the bill how we did it. We'll hold it, we'll amend it, and get it out of here next Monday with your amendment. So next Monday we'll have your amendment ready and have it and do the bill. And between now and then we'll discuss that and decide whether we're going to include it in the omnibus or move it separately.
And, Mr. Chairman, what we could do, too, is if you wanted to move it to represent Wagenius' committee, that is perfectly fine with me. We can always add it as an amendment to the Game and Fish Bill later when you put that bill together.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can have a little more definitive information by next Monday what the cost is going to be, and we can decide that at that time. And Mr. Kadelka will discuss that with you when he gets the information from the department. Is that
absolutely fine with me, Mr.
Chairman. Okay, so... Representative Hackbarth renews his... No further questions by the committee? Okay. Representative Hackbarth renews his very lengthy motion here, and we'll hold it in our committee, and we'll deal with it next Monday. It'll be the first thing up on the agenda Monday. Got that, Mr. Kadelka? Okay. Very good.
Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Hoppe, are you willing to move the Narnas bill?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 152. What do you want to do with this? Recommend that we hold it over for possible inclusion?
And the motion is to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources with a recommended referral to the Committee on Finance and for a re-referral to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division. So ultimately, this will end up over at Representative Wagenius after this very long... We're going to have to write paragraphs and books of these motions as it looks up. Welcome, Representative Narnas, to the committee. To House File 152. It is your floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. We're not going to take all 7 minutes here, hopefully. of your committee time. House File 152 is a very short bill, but just a few lines. It's here because I had some constituents who happen to be senior citizens that still remember when the state had a free fishing license. And that went away a few years ago, and they still remind me about that. So as this session was getting started, again, I was reminded once more that they wanted their free fishing license back. Well, I know we have to compromise in this place, and so that's why I'm here with suggesting a half-price fishing license. So it's sort of a sale, but it's not free. So that's basically what this does. It instead of having a full price for the seniors, a single angler would be paying $8.50. I would like to suggest an amendment to this short bill, I think, because I've talked to the DNR and others, and I know there's some concern about the impact that this would have on their budgets. So
go ahead with your amendment.
Without talking to my senior citizens, I'm going to be bold and suggest that we change a line. Okay, I don't have a copy of the bill here, so I'm not sure which line it is, but where it says 65, change that to 70.
To 70.
Here we go.
Okay, Representative Norness would like to amend line 1.10, item number 2, in changing the age from 65 to 70, in essence, decreasing the number of people that would be eligible, the way I read the amendment.
That's correct.
For the bill.
It's 1.9 and 1.10, I think.
1.9 and 1.10, that is correct, to 70 years old. Okay, all in favor of the amendment, say aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. Bill is amended. House File 152. Go ahead.
Okay, I have really nothing more right now at this time. There's at least one individual here who would like to address the bill.
Okay, I'd like to come forward, whoever is here, to address the bill.
He's a friend of mine, and I think he's...
Well, we'll mark that down that you've got a friend. Okay, welcome, and introduce yourself to the committee, and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Dave Thompson. I'm a resort owner in the Otter Tail area, and I've been on the Citizen Oversight Committee for a number of years. I was on the Citizen Oversight Committee when we made the change and recommended the change to take away the senior citizen discount. And it was actually my idea to do this. We did research in our committee on demographics that DNR provided on the seniors' ability to pay as far as income and the amount of people involved. And our concern was just that a lot of us on the committee were baby boomers, and we were getting close to the age of retirement also, and we felt that there was going to be a huge impact on the game and fish budget as we all got older, and there was going to be less and less money income. As it's worked out over the past 10 years of history on the game and fish in the DNR fisheries budget, the legislature has appropriated less and less and less money to the fisheries budget. 10 years ago, there was over $55 million allocated to DNR in general, and fisheries got about $3 million of that 10 years ago. Last year, there was only $35 million sent to DNR in general fund dollars, and fisheries got less than $500,000. One year, we only got $25,000 in general fund dollars. If this bill goes through, it would have the fiscal impact in front of you, it looks like, to be about $500,000 to $700,000 worth of income or impact, and that is more than the legislature now gives the fisheries budget in general fund dollars. And when Ron Pyre made his presentation earlier, you could see from the pie chart that the fisheries division is 97% funded by dedicated funds, and only 2% comes from the general fund. So if this bill passes, it will have a dramatic impact on the fisheries budget.
Questions from members on the bill as amended, House File 152? Okay, someone from the department? Representative Moe, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. More a comment, I think, and especially directed at the testifier last
gentleman who spoke. You know, and Representative Nornis knows that Let's Go Fishing has a chapter in Bemidji, which is a program that's partially supported here by the state of Minnesota. They take many guides, volunteers, stretch these dollars as far as possible to get seniors out fishing in our local lakes. Many of these seniors are picked up at Gold Pine Nursing Home and other subsidized nursing homes and assisted care facilities. And I hear a lot from them too. Anything that we can do actually to get more of them out fishing and not less. Many of them say they said I haven't done this in 15 or 20 years. And the quality of life that we can bring to them by making this easier for them and not more difficult, I think would be terrific. And I, you know, but now that I got to wait 29 years as opposed to 25 to get one of these things, I'm kind of on the fence here, bud. But other than that, I really support your bill.
Representative Nornis. I was going to say that I'm close to that 65, so in the interest of not having any self-interest in this bill, that's why I also wanted to move it to 70. So.
Well, it also, Representative Nornis, lessens the, I'm pretty certain that it will lessen the impact financially to some degree. I don't know, and we have some, I had a fiscal note on it at 65.
Right.
It's fairly, you know, somewhat expensive.
Right.
And I sense that the longer we go in, we're getting older, and it's going to be more expensive as we move into future years. But
Mr. Chair, it'd be my desire that as we go forward, and hopefully we can move forward and continue to talk about it, that we look at the other issue that Mr. Thompson talked about, and that's how we fund the fisheries. I think that you know, we need to. I don't want this bill to be negative to their efforts. So hopefully, within our surplus, maybe we can find a couple of dollars that'll help out. I don't know, but I think I'd like to make sure that we work as hard as we can. Again, because I also agree. Seniors tell me they've quit fishing. They tell me that the DNR says that they haven't, but I know personally a number of them that have, and this is a small deal. Whether it's $17 or $8.50, probably isn't. It's kind of the principle of the thing for some of them, and they just think the government has again added one more little misery to their life, and they've asked me.
Well, thank you. I have a question for the department, Mr. Bogus. Mr. Bogus, my recollection is that for we get a buck for a fishing license and we get another buck from somewhere else or more money. How does that work? Can you remind the committee of how we get our the federal money for things like this?
Mr. Chair and members, there's on both the fishing and hunting side, there's what we call federal aid for fishing. It's Dingle Johnson, and then Walbro was an expansion on that. It's federal money that's derived from federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment, and on the fishery side, some of the boating equipment and that sort of thing that's used for fishing. And we get money back. It's a reimbursement, 75% reimbursement, based on each state gets that money based on a formula that uses the number of licensed buyers in the state, and then the area of the state. It's a little slightly different formula for fishing than for hunting. In hunting, it's 50-50, those two in the formula, and fishing at 60-40, and I don't off the top of my head recall which is 60 and which is 40, but there is money that comes back to us for every licensed buyer.
Is there a cap on that, on the federal money?
Well, there's a large pie of federal money that's divided amongst every state and a lot of the provinces and commonwealths and all that. So, but the amount that we get of that, our slice of that pie is based on our number, to some extent, on the number of licensed anglers that we have in the state. That's why back when we had a free license, all those seniors didn't qualify in that formula, and we were losing some of that federal money that would have been allocated to Minnesota. We're capturing all of our allocation, but the number of licensed buyers affects how much we're eligible to capture.
On the fiscal note that we've got, that would take into account the federal money that comes in as well, or is that just the license revenue that comes in, not in the absence of the federal money?
Mr. Chairman, this the way this bill is structured, it would not affect that federal money, because as long as it's a paid license buyer and it's more than just a token type of a fee, it still counts as a licensed buyer. So this does not affect our federal money.
All right. Okay, any further questions? Anyone to testify for or against the bill beyond what we've already heard? All right. Anybody else in the committee? Okay, there being none, Representative Hoppe renews his very lengthy motion, which will ultimately end up at Environment, Natural Resources, Finance. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thanks. All right, members, Monday we'll be back here and be looking for the agendas. Thank you very much.